And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and this morning I have the honor to once again speak with renowned author Scott Wiedenthal. Scott has written 30 books, including the Pulitzer Prize finalist, Living on the Wind, and the New York Times bestseller, A World on the Wing. His latest book is titled The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet. Scott Wiedenthal, thank you so much for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be back. Thank you for having me, Claire.
Well, I am excited to talk to you about your new book, but first, let's paint the complete picture of who you are and your story. Where and when did this love of birds and conservation begin for you?
I literally cannot remember a time that I was not a sort of a museum-quality nature nerd, as far back as I can remember. Birders often talk about having a spark bird that got them interested in birding. I don't have a spark bird. I don't remember a spark bird. There have been moments that crystallized things for me where I, you know, really got hooked on raptors because I think raptors are the coolest of all birds. And, you know, times when I got hooked on the phenomenon of migration that has really driven a lot of my personal and professional life. But, I don't have an academic degree in science. I dropped out of college my junior year of my undergrad, never went back and finished it. So it's been a really odd, circuitous route that I've taken over the years, from being a college art major who wanted to be a wildlife artist to being a newspaper reporter to getting into raptor rehabilitation and then raptor banding and then deeper and deeper into migration research, and now involved with a whole bunch of migration research projects over the years, working with some really terrific colleagues studying owl migration and hummingbird migration and, you know, migratory birds migrating out of Denali Park in Alaska, working with the National Park Service. It's been a heck of a ride, I can tell you. It's been a lot of fun. And I get to write about it, which is the really cool thing. I get to share this with people. I am not the person you invite to career day at school, except possibly to say, don't do what he did.
No, I would argue that you are a scholar in life and you have circumvented the globe looking into how birds affect our world. And I think it's wonderful that you have steeped yourself in this path and that you have taught us many things along the way.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
Well, we appreciate you, and your books are absolutely wonderful. Our show, sometimes the topics can be heavy when you're talking about the planet and conservation. Yeah. But in your very first sentence in your new book, The Return of the Oyster Catcher, you say that this is a book about optimism. Why did you think it was important for you to set the table in that way, that optimism is an important way to look at our planet?
Well, for one thing, I finished the book in March of last year, and it was already really clear that this was going to be a very difficult time for the environment, for conservation, for science. But the fact is, all around the world, including many places in the U.S., people are turning the dial for bird conservation. We're making progress for bird conservation. And I guess I went from thinking that this was the worst possible timing that I could have for an optimistic book about bird conservation to thinking maybe it's the best possible timing for an optimistic book about bird conservation. Because I think we need to remember that no matter how deep a hole we've dug ourselves into, we can get ourselves back out of it again. And part of that is my own personal experience. I'm 67 years old. I graduated high school during the bicentennial year of 1976, at the peak of the DDT era, when, you know, on top of several centuries worth of raptor persecution, then we had organochloride pesticides like DDT that were decimating, you know, bald eagle populations and peregrine falcons and ospreys and brown pelicans, you know, so many birds at the end of long food chains. That year that I graduated high school, there were fewer than 1,000 bald eagles in the entirety of the lower 48. If you had told me that 50 years later, on the 250th anniversary of our nation's founding, that there would be 400,000 bald eagles in the lower 48, I would have thought you were delusional. I would have asked what you were smoking. But here we are. You know, we brought bald eagles back. We can do more than we think we can. And I think we also underestimate the resiliency of nature in general and birds in particular, kind of at our peril. If we throw up our hands and say, it's hopeless, there's nothing we can do, that's the only guarantee that we're going to fail. You know, I hope the stories in this book, from across the United States and in some places in the world, like, you know, the edge of the war zone in Ukraine, where they've got some really serious problems and yet are pushing ahead with conservation and making the world a better place for birds and people. I think those are all stories that we can use right now.
Agreed. And you had just mentioned it there, that bold statement of saving birds to save the planet. Those are big words, and yet you share with us throughout the book how this is true and how we are watching migratory birds. And right here in our own state, Utah, our eye is on the Great Salt Lake, and that is obviously a place in which migratory birds come every year, and they feed on the brine shrimp and they feed on the brine flies. And if that goes away, even changing that pattern could be a
Oh,
ripple effect
absolutely.
across the world. So tell
Absolutely.
me some examples of these birds that you're seeing throughout the nation or even the planet that are showing what is happening to our planet, but in saving them, how we can move forward and how we can keep that eye on hope.
Well, you mentioned ripple effects, and I think one of the best examples of ripple effects in this book, the story of Project Puffin on the coast of Maine, back in the 1970s, when a young biologist named Steve Kress, who worked for the National Audubon Society, discovered, kind of to his surprise, reading a historical book, that there had been an Atlantic puffin colony on these two little islands in the southern Gulf of Maine, Eastern Egg Rock and Western Egg Rock. He knew them as gull colonies. There were no puffins out there. And when he found out that these puffins had been, you know, hunted into extinction in the late 19th century, Steve decided to bring the puffins back to Eastern Egg Rock. Of course, nobody had ever done that before, and it took years of like really stubborn effort and a lot of trial and error and experimentation, you know, translocating puffin chicks from big healthy colonies in Canada, and they're bringing them down and trying to figure out how to keep them alive and feed them and protect them from predators. And once those chicks fledged, you know, to how to lure them back to that island by using decoys and using audio lure, so it, you know, to mimic the sound of a busy seabird colony, so they'd want to be there and start to nest because they thought there were lots of others there. And he succeeded, and they brought puffins back, not just Eastern Egg Rock, but to many islands in the Gulf of Maine. But what's really cool is that the techniques that they came up with in the 1970s and 80s in Maine are being used with literally hundreds of species of endangered seabirds all over the world. You never know how far these ripples are going to go. And, you know, one bright idea that one person has in one place can spark conservation that goes all over the world.
So if we look at ripple effects of birds and what they're doing for our planet and those ecosystems, what are some examples that you can give that the roles that they play are important for our planet?
Oh, it's kind of hard to think of a way that they're not, frankly. Ecologists often use the term ecological services, like the birds are doing us a favor by pollinating and, you know, swallowing fruits and distributing seeds in their droppings and controlling insects and, you know, doing all these things that birds do just in order to survive. And all of that is true. You know, you take birds out of the picture, and, you know, in many places, you know, entire ecosystems would fall apart. Just reading an article just yesterday about the importance of cassowaries in the forests of northern Australia and Papua New Guinea, because they're the only animal that's big enough to distribute the seeds of these really big tropical fruits. You know, that's just one example. I'm sitting up here right now in New Hampshire after what I've got to tell you. Unlike out west, we had a good old-fashioned New England winter this year. We're, you know, not trying to make skiers in Utah feel jealous about that,
We're
I
a little
swear.
jealous.
But, you know, I'm just craving the return of our neotropical migrants and the fact that in the next couple of weeks, you know, the forests are going to be full of warblers and vireos and tanagers and thrushes and flycatchers and hummingbirds and all this stuff coming back and bringing back with them those ecological connections, you know, helping to keep our northern hardwood forests here in balance, because as soon as they arrive, the trees open up, the leaves return, and in those leaves there are going to be millions and millions and millions of caterpillars. And that's all bird food. The birds need that food, but the trees also need those birds to keep those caterpillars under control. It's when we see the world shift out of balance that we really come to understand what each and every part of it, including all these species of birds, are contributing to the overall year-to-year stability of those ecosystems. And it's, I mean, go to the island of Guam, where brown tree snakes ate all, wiped out almost all the birds. I mean, the forests of Guam are empty except for millions and millions and millions of spiders, because there's no birds there to eat them. So it's just like the, gigantic Mirkwood out of, The Hobbit. You've got this forest that's encased, sort of entombed in spider webs. That's what happens when things go badly off the rails.
I remember when I was a kid, I had this, I think it was a card game, and it was called Endangered Species. And there were different pictures of different animals, and they talked about what the population was. And I remember having a visceral reaction to the buzzards and the vultures. Those weren't as, I guess, endearing. And as a kid, especially, I'm like, oh, the buzzards and the vultures. But you have a chapter
Oh,
in
yeah.
this book that talks about rescuing the unlovely. And obviously, as I got older, I saw beyond just what that outside showed us and some of the ways in which we think about vultures, but how important they really are to our world.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, scavenging birds like vultures are among the most endangered group of birds in the world. And you don't hear much about that because, let's face it, if you're a conservation organization and you send out your big fundraising appeal and you put a vulture on there, you're probably not going to generate nearly as much in the way of donations as if you put, something cute and charismatic on there. But we have seen, and this goes back to those, the question of ecological services and ripple effects, what happens when birds disappear. We've seen what happens in places like South Asia, where 95, 98% of the vultures died in the matter of about 15 years because they were being inadvertently poisoned by diclofenac, which is an analgesic that farmers started giving it to their livestock because a cow that doesn't have aches and pains is going to give you more milk. The problem is, for old world vultures, which are a different evolutionary branch than our new world vultures, our turkey vultures and black vultures and condors, old world vultures are exquisitely sensitive to NSAID analgesics like diclofenac. And if they eat a carcass that had been treated within a couple of days of its death with diclofenac, it just killed them by the Well, killed them by the millions. The South Asian vulture population completely collapsed. And all of a sudden, people realized that, again, the service that these birds were doing by cleaning up carcasses and cleaning up carrion. And with the vultures gone, among other things, feral dog populations exploded across countries like India and Pakistan, Nepal, Tibet. Cases of human rabies went through the roof. In the areas where these birds disappeared, human lifespan shrank. It actually, average lifespan actually retreated. Having so much carrion on the landscape increased the incidence of disease spreading. Diclofenac and other NSAID analgesics have largely been banned now in South Asia. There's a modest recovery of vulture populations, but I mean, at one point, most of the remaining vultures were taken up into captivity and brought into captive breeding programs to try to slowly rebuild their numbers. It unfortunately continues at pace in places like Africa. There's a lot of both intentional and unintentional poisoning going on in Africa, either people poisoning vultures intentionally to kill them, because in some parts of Africa, vulture body parts are considered to be good luck, so they're used in kind of traditional folk beliefs, like having a vulture head is good luck, kind of the way we used to think having a rabbit's foot was lucky. So it's been hard to be a vulture.
It's interesting to me how much humans separate ourselves from the natural world. It's like we extract ourselves in a way that can become detrimental for not only our flora and fauna, but ultimately for ourselves.
Oh,
And
sure.
you've done so much work in discovering relationships with the natural world, in particular birds. So, in all of these years that you have worked within the patterns and the understanding of how birds relate to our natural world, when you close your eyes and you think about the many places that you've been, is there one that immediately comes to mind to you as a powerful example?
Wow, So many possibilities. But one of the places, and it's ironic that one of the greatest wildlife spectacles on Earth, and it's happening right now, as it happens every spring, is like occurs like less than a mile from Interstate 80 along the Platte River in Nebraska, when you have the northbound migration of sandhill cranes. You want to talk about a conservation success story? There's 600,000 sandhill cranes that stage up every year along that middle stretch of the Platte River. One of the reasons that they're doing so well is because they, you know, we humans leave a buffet for them in the form of waste grain in fields. These cranes that have wintered in the desert southwest or northern Mexico are stopping off there and filling up on the waste grain of the Corn Belt and then carrying that grain far up into the Arctic. There are ways that we can coexist with birds in ways that we can manage the land to our benefit and to the benefit of the other animals, the other creatures that live on it. It's not an either or. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't take much on our part, you know, a little bit of compromise on our part to craft a world that works for us and works for them. We just have to be open to it.
Right. And the book does call out the oyster catcher in its title. Why did you use that bird as the symbol?
Well, another group of birds that's in really serious danger are shorebirds. Our shorebird populations in North America overall have declined by 60 to 90% in the last 50 years, but particularly those that use the Atlantic Flyway, those populations have really seen significant declines. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that. Habitat loss is one. There's still a lot of legal and illegal shorebird shooting that happens in the Caribbean and in parts of South America where those populations winter. Part of it may be competition on their Arctic breeding grounds with snow geese, which until recently, snow goose populations were exploding almost completely out of control, and they were turning a lot of coastal wetlands in the Arctic into basically mud flats, which doesn't do anybody any good. But there are two exceptions to that rather grim trend in the East. One are piping plovers, and the other are oyster catchers. And I thought the oyster catcher was a really good example because when we think about wildlife conservation, the idea of a business plan is not the first thing that comes to mind. I mean, usually, you know, those like recovery plans, and it's all based on biology. And so, American oyster catchers, the population I'm writing about in the book is the one on the Atlantic and Gulf Coast. And these birds had been hunted, as most, almost all shorebirds were, hunted right to the edge in the late 19th and early 20th century during the market hunting period because they taste good and they decoy well. But unlike waterfowl, they don't have a really high reproductive potential, so they can't take that kind of annual hunting pressure. So their numbers were really low, and then they received federal protection. And through the early 20th century, oyster catcher numbers were recovering and they were expanding further and further north up the coast and reclaiming places like New England, where they'd been completely extirpated in the late 19th and early 20th century. And then we got past World War II. And for all of these beach nesting birds, and piping plovers and oyster catchers both nest on the beach, in the sand, in the dunes. Well, suddenly, millions and millions and millions of Americans were heading for the beach every summer. And in many parts of the coast, they were driving on the beach. And so any oyster catcher or piping plover that was nesting there was getting flattened. So their numbers, the oyster catcher numbers kept going down further and further and further. And by about 2008, they'd been dropping for decades. And the prediction from oyster catcher conservationists was that if nothing changed, it was going to continue to drop by another 10 or 12% over the next 10 years. But that didn't happen because the American Oyster Catcher Working Group, which is a bunch of scientists who were really focused on oyster catcher conservation, said, why don't we pull together everybody that's working on oyster catcher conservation? So we're talking about, in the end, more than 40 different NGOs and institutions and agencies and work in a concerted way. And they ran some numbers and they realized, you know, if we can increase the productivity of each oyster catcher nest by an average of just half a chick per nest per year, by reducing the threats that they're facing, we can reduce beach disturbance, if we can just bring it up by half a chick per nest per year, we can go from expecting a 12% decline in the next 10 years to a 30% increase. In the years since then, oyster catcher populations have gone up by 45% on the Atlantic coast at a time when I said most other shorebird numbers continue to decline. So even for groups of birds like shorebirds that have proven to be a real conservation challenge, if we put the time and the effort and the know-how and the money into it, it's a roadmap for recovery. We know what we need to do. We just need to do it.
And the last question that I have for you is turning to indigenous communities and the way in which they approach the land and they approach the creatures on it. As you said, if we look for a path forward and we look for those roadmaps, really, it lies a lot within the indigenous community, it seems. Why are they a central pillar for bird recovery, do you think?
Well, for one thing, there was a survey done not too long ago that found that about 80% of the world's biodiversity exists on lands that are controlled by indigenous communities around the world. They have been stewarding that land for a very long time, and surprise, surprise, they know what they're doing. They know how to maintain that biodiversity. The biodiversity on indigenous protected land is generally higher even than on, formally protected lands like parks. And this is the final chapter in the book, and I think the part of the book that really moves me the most is what's going on primarily in the boreal forest of Canada with indigenous communities up there. And I got to spend some time in a place called Thedéné-Néné National Park Reserve, which is part of Thedéné-Néné Indigenous Protected Area in the Northwest Territories. It's 6.5 million acres of the most jaw-droppingly beautiful northern landscape you can imagine. It's on the east arm of Great Slave Lake, which is the deepest lake in North America. It is staggeringly beautiful, and it's part of the boreal forest of North America, which at 1.5 billion acres is the largest intact forest on the planet. And it is also home to more than 300 species of breeding birds, many of them migratory. The boreal forest is a bird factory of global significance. And in the past, relatively little of the boreal forest was in any kind of formal conservation protection. And in fact, in the parts of the boreal forest that were put in formal conservation protection by being made game sanctuaries or Canadian national parks, it was at the loss of the indigenous communities that had lived there since time immemorial, because they were, for the most part, told, you can no longer hunt here, you can no longer fish here, you can no longer forage here. This is a protected place. And so the people that had been living there since the ice melted at the end of that last ice age were told they could no longer follow their traditional lifestyles. Deeply, deeply unfair. And for that reason, the people in that live the indigenous community, the Lhtso Kaye Dene First Nation and their surrounding First Nation neighbors that live around the east arm of Great Slave Lake, had been fighting the Canadian government for years to prevent a national park from going in. They'd fought heroically to prevent that because they had seen what had happened elsewhere in Canada where native communities were kicked off the land. But they eventually realized, particularly with the growth of diamond mining and base metal mining that was encroaching on their ancestral land, that they needed some sort of formal protection that the world at large would recognize. And so they began this, what turned into an almost 20-year process of negotiating with Parks Canada to create a park that was recognized by the Canadian government and by the government of the Northwest Territories, but was under Indigenous control. That the people who have lived there since the glaciers went away are the ones who are mapping out how best to manage it and how best. And in fact, they don't even use the word manage. They don't have a management board. They have what they call a relationship board, because they feel that it's not their place to manage the land. And so what started at Thedéné-Néné has sparked this movement of indigenous protected areas across the Canadian boreal forest, and actually across Canada in general, which is the way it ought to be.
And in that story, there's so much to digest for the brain, but also the heart as well. You put a lot of heart into this book. It's called The Return of the Oyster Catcher, Saving Birds to Save the Planet, and it is authored by Scott Wiedensahl.
I would hope that when folks finished reading it, they'd come away with a sense that all is not lost and that there's every reason for us to take a deep breath and get back in the fight, because it's a world worth fighting for.
Very well said. Well, thank you so much for being a part of the show. I really do appreciate it. And if people want to learn more about you, where would they go? Do you have a website?
I do. And it's just scottwiedensahl.com, W-E-I-D-E-N-S-A-U-L.com.